This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of February, and I'd say this was a pretty busy week. We had the Iowa caucuses, sort of. The Iowa Democratic Party has had intense difficulty counting the votes in the caucus, in part because the rules governing the caucus are more complicated and arbitrary than the tax code. It seems clear that Bernie Sanders got the most votes, while Pete Buttigieg appears to have maybe eked out a plurality of the state's delegates, in part because he did especially well in rural areas. Or maybe it's going to be a tie in delegates. We'll probably know by March. The president also gave the State of the Union address, and he got acquitted in his impeachment trial, after which he gave a triumphant, I guess we can call it a speech, in the East Room of the White House, where he remarked that the whole Russia thing has been, quote, bull. Now the Democratic candidates are in New Hampshire, preparing for next Tuesday's primary. And I am here with the Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, commentary editor of the Washington Examiner on the right. And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, Josh.
Tim, what did you make of the president's State of the Union speech?
It was amazing theater. We got a reality television show president. And this was the first time that he really did it up that way. The fact that half of the speech, most of the speech, was him just introducing the people in the room and, like, almost Oprah Winfrey-like, presenting new cars to people. You know, he hands out scholarships. He introduces a soldier coming home to the long, lonely bride who was in the chamber. He gave out a Medal of Freedom. So I'm not saying I think that this is sort of the way a president should do these addresses. I kind of don't like these addresses. There's way too many standing ovations and that sort of thing. But if you're going to do it, he did it the way only Donald Trump could do it. Somebody once told me about writing, the best you can do is be the best you can be. That sounds like a third grade teacher, right? Donald Trump was the best Donald Trump he could be with that reality TV show State of the Union.
Liz, does that concern you that if he was the best Donald Trump he could be in this speech, and maybe you dispute that characterization, is that something that looks like an effective approach toward a general election where Democrats are going to be trying to deny him a second term? Did he make a case in here that you're afraid is going to connect with people?
I mean, I think he has been doing that all along, right? I mean, so Trump has been the Trumpiest Trump he could be at his rallies for a long time, right? So this was just a showing in an official capacity where Trump took up the Trump that he often is at his rallies, which is a little bit jocular, extremely patriotic, and concerned with things that I think strike lots of liberals as ridiculous pageantry, but do appear to actually mean quite a bit to everyday Americans, that being the sort of outreach to the military and the honoring of American heroes and survivors and so forth. So, I mean, is it a way that Trump connects with voters? Absolutely. It's not a new way. It's a way that he's been connecting with voters since 16 and in a way that he continues to and rallies around the country. I do think that liberals need to have a better answer to that than what Nancy Pelosi did, which was to rip up her copy of the speech. Seemed to be this riff on her clapping at him the last time around. She was even wearing something identical, I think, to what she was wearing then. She seemed to enjoy the, let's say, adulation she got out of that. So she went with this tactic this time. I don't think it really landed. It seemed to fall a little bit flat.
I felt like this speech felt like three speeches attached to each other. It was almost like they'd been written by three different speechwriters. The first part was largely about the economy, and I thought the first part was quite effective. I mean, it makes a somewhat overstated case about how good the economy is, but the economy is good by objective measures. And when you look at survey data on how people feel about the economy, people tend to feel about as good about the economy as they felt in the last 20 years. It's a real point of political strength for the president to talk about low unemployment and things of that nature. And as I was watching the speech, my initial reaction was, oh, Democrats really should be afraid of this. If Trump focused more on this messaging and less on various other nonsense he does, then his approval numbers would be a lot higher. They'd be up around where they are on the economy. There are a substantial number of voters who say that they approve of how Trump is handling the economy but don't approve of how he's handling the presidency overall. Then the second part was sort of the, you know, immigrants are coming to kill you part that did feel like a lot what you hear at rallies from the president. And divisive. I certainly, you know, I understand that this works to activate certain parts of his base, but I think the majority of the country has all along found this off-putting. And then the third part focused on foreign policy, and I thought was a little bit weird. There were like these George W. Bush-style notes about promoting democracy in Venezuela, which the administration hasn't actually done that much around. I mean, there were some concerns that we might stage some military intervention there. We clearly haven't done that. He talked about the importance of bringing troops home from Afghanistan, which is a popular position, but of course, he's been president for more than 3 years, and he hasn't actually done that. So I thought that undermined the messaging a little bit. And then I had a slightly different take on Pelosi ripping up the speech. I thought that was effective in that it helped shape the coverage of the speech over the next day. And it was basically coverage that focused a lot around Trump makes partisan speech that gets partisan positive and negative reaction in the chamber, and less about Trump touts low unemployment. And so Tim, I'm wondering what you made of that move from Pelosi, because I think if Trump truly had message discipline, it would have been a mistake on her part, because Trump would have been able to rise above it and say, well, I'm going to talk about how, you know, great things are going in America. And if Nancy Pelosi wants to be negative, she can be negative. Of course, instead, he gets into the negative back and forth, and it sort of stomps on his economy message.
Yeah, surely the baiting Trump is a big part of what the Democratic strategy has been since the 2016 general election. And when Hillary would talk about how easy he was to bait, and then, you know, in various ways, I think they tried to do that. I thought it was prudent because it would bring out the evident vices, his lack of virtue, his lack of self-restraint. But on the other hand, lowering yourself to his level and fighting with him still brings yourself down to his level, and it's hard to win at his game. I thought it struck me as incredibly petty when I watched it. I saw on Twitter lots of go girl reaction out there, and I just thought, how's the average person going to think about this? Are there sort of union guys who stayed home because they wouldn't vote Republican but didn't like Hillary? Are they going to now show up and say, okay, the Democratic Party is fighting for me, or are they going to be put off and say, this is a sort of pettiness? So my reaction, it's hard to tell how the average voter reacts when we're not average at all. I'm definitely a conservative who doesn't like Trump. But my reaction was, this mostly makes her look petty.
Liz, I was wondering what you thought of the foreign policy part of the speech, whether you saw a through line, a vision that the president was presenting of America's role in the world.
Well, you know, Trump's been a little bit erratic on foreign policy. You know, I think that those of us who braced ourselves when Trump won in 2016 hoped that he would stick to this dovishness that he has telegraphed. And, you know, it's been a bumpy road there. This recent flare-up with Iran being the most disturbing departure from what had been otherwise a pretty steady commitment to hesitance and humility in terms of American military force worldwide. You know, you'd hope to see Trump stick to that. I don't put a lot of stock in the messages that he telegraphs in his speeches, precisely because of these incidents where you start to see behavior that's a little bit unpredictable. But I would hope that, you know, those impulses that he has somehow rule the day in the end.
Yeah, foreign policy for Trump has always been this tension between him, I think, instinctually, as Liz is saying, being where a lot of Americans are, which is to say, it's not our job to go mess with everybody else. And that's why he talks the way he does about Afghanistan, but also a kind of toughness. When the democracy promotion in South America leaks in there, that definitely does look like a speechwriter putting it in there and not something Trump actually cares about. But ultimately, yes, every president has had rhetoric on foreign policy that has differed from their actual action. And so I think the interesting thing is that Trump mostly has done foreign policy the way we thought he would, which is he'll kind of punch you in the face if you mess with us, but he doesn't have an interest in a long ongoing war in another part of the world.
The response to this speech came from Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor of Michigan, and she painted this negative picture of the economy. And I get when Democratic presidential candidates do this. When you look at the polling, Democrats have much more negative views on the economy than Republicans do, which is typical. Usually the party of the president in power feels better about the economy than the party of the president out of power. But this speech, it seemed like, was supposed to be aimed at general election messaging, and I just didn't really buy some of what she had to say here when she was saying, you know, when the president says the economy is strong, my question is, strong for whom? Strong for the wealthy who are reaping rewards from tax cuts they don't need. The American economy needs to be a different kind of strong. Liz, you've talked about that you'd like to see Democratic candidates messaging this by saying, you know, why can't we take the strength of our economy and use it to invest in things that are better for more people? You know, if the economy is strong, why can't we afford to do X, Y, and Z? But it seems to me like Whitmer here is basically just trying to deny the premise that the economy is strong, which I just feel like doesn't really fly, at least in a general election.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I think that Democrats feel sort of boxed in because this obviously is a strength for Trump. And I think you've seen Democrats try to message that in different ways. Some of them have said, yes, well, the strength of the economy is really a residual from Obama. The strength of the economy is unpredictable and has nothing to do with the president. It comes and goes. Answer that you get is the one that Widmer had, which is, it's not really that strong for everyone. It's certainly the case that there are still Americans who are struggling right now. But there's really no denying that it's a very tight job market and by lots of other indicators, a pretty strong economy. So, I mean, if it were me, I would be saying, yes, that's great. We're doing well. We're at the top of our game. So why is it that? Mothers still have children and then have to go back to work 2 weeks later or have to worry about whether they can take off any time at all. Why is it that there are people who have to work when they're sick in the food service industry, for instance, and make other people sick? You know, right now, everybody's concerned about coronavirus. These kinds of policies are precisely how those dangerous illnesses spread and so on and so forth. We don't have the CDC properly staffed, by the way. Which is not related to the economy, but there are several ways that I think you could take this. Things are going really well. So why are there all of these gaps that we have? And I think you could run with it. But the reality is that Democrats don't know if the nominee who's going to be running against Trump in the general is actually going to be taking that tack. You know, if it's someone like Biden or Buttigieg, which I don't consider very likely, but it's a possibility, they're not interested in those kinds of massive overhaul programs that, say, Bernie Sanders is. So I think Democrats are wary of messaging on that too much.
And it's actually factually wrong to say the economy is not working for the working class and sort of the bottom 50%. When you look at wages over the last couple of years, there's a greater increase in wages for the poor and working class than there is for the average American and certainly for the top 25% of income. With inflation being low, that really matters to people who, you know, have somewhat fixed budgets. And with unemployment at 3.6%, and that's because more people are entering into the workforce, it's still down at 3.6%. What you've got is intense competition for workers. I hear employers complaining about how hard it is to hold on to workers. And that's bad news for some employers. It's very good news for the working class. So this lecture about the economy's not working, I have to wonder, are these people just borrowing a lecture from 5-6 years ago when it was more true, or are they hoping that their voters don't know? Because if, again, Democrats are going to try in the general election to win over the working class that they lost so much of to Trump in 2016, why are they trying to tell them that their life is horrible when these people see that their economic prospects have been going way up for the last few years?
And I mean, I think, you know, Democrats taking that into account would be wise to say things are good for now. But anyone who remembers 2008 can remember how quickly life can turn around financially. And so, you know, it should be a forewarning to working class people who are getting good wages and who have employment now because they, in most cases, don't have wealth. So these sort of countercyclical programs that would protect against another big bust like we had in 2008 would be really helpful because we know for a fact that strong economies don't hold out forever. And oftentimes they don't just taper off. They completely explode. And that's a concern that I think working class people especially should be very tuned into and that Democrats would be wise to message on.
Well, and I think one place where they really have been messaging that is on healthcare. And Liz, I would disagree a little bit with the idea that you can only make these arguments about, you know, possibility if you're running on a transformative left-wing agenda. I think you can also do it by running against possibilities about what Republicans might do. This is what Democrats did in 2018, running on the popular status quo on healthcare, or at least more popular than what Republicans wanted to do in terms of repealing Obamacare, with a message of, we're going to protect your health plan, we're going to protect the protection that you have to ensure coverage of pre-existing conditions that Republicans are currently suing to try to get rid of in the courts. And you did see some of that in Whitmer's speech, basically saying, you know, Democrats have all of these different health care plans, but what they have in common is that they seek to expand coverage. They protect pre-existing conditions. The president is suing to try to take those away. And in fact, the president lied about that in his State of the Union address, repeating this false claim that he is going to protect pre-existing conditions at a time that his administration is in the courts arguing that those protections should be thrown out. And so I think that, you know, I think that that is one area where Democrats really do have a strong message available on an economic issue in spite of the strong economy. My pet theory is part of the reason that Trump's numbers have been marginally improving over the last few months is just that this stuff has been out of the news. And so to the extent that Democrats can make that a focus, I think that's an electoral advantage to them. And I think they do have the opportunity to do that regardless of who they end up nominating. I want to talk quickly about the impeachment trial, because Trump's acquittal was not a surprise, but the surprise at the trial was that all the Democrats held together and voted to convict the president on both counts, while Mitt Romney defected from Republicans, voting to convict him on the one abuse of power count. That makes Mitt Romney the first senator ever in American history to vote to remove a president of his own party in an impeachment trial. Tim, did Mitt make the right call?
I believe that Mitt Romney actually voted his conscience there. And I really believe that that's the only thing you can ask of lawmakers and people in positions of power like that, is to consult their principles, know all the facts, pray, and come to the decision that goes along with their conscience. Now, a lot of my friends on the right, and not just MAGA heads, but my friend Michael Brendan Doherty, questions that. He thinks that there's enough motivation for Mitt Romney to sort of seek liberal adulation or to go with the wind, that there was an advantage to him casting this vote, despite the fact that he's running in Utah, which is an overwhelmingly Republican state, pointing to Romney's past. Romney has flip-flopped on abortion and on gay marriage and on immigration and all sorts of things, and saying it's hard to believe that Romney has principles. But I know that for myself and a lot of my conservative friends who are Trump skeptical, we spent the whole impeachment debate and the whole trial being torn and being close to one side or the other. I came down thinking I'd probably vote no, but only probably. And so when Romney came down, you know, sort of just a few yards away from where I came down, I believe that it was him voting his conscience, which, again, I think is all that we can ask of people.
Liz, what did you make of the president's sort of victory lap performance in the East Room?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess we all knew this where it was headed. I hope that Democrats got what they wanted out of it. They have it on the record that the House, you know, sent articles of impeachment to the Senate. They really didn't think the Senate was going to remove him, and they were right. You know, I haven't seen quite a lot of polling yet that would tell me how this has been received by the public. I know Trump's favorables have been creeping back up. Yeah, hard to say what it did in the end, this entire experiment. I say we leave that where it is and go on to 2020.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times to talk about Iowa. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. The Iowa caucus is all over but the counting, which is usually something you say when the polls close, but I'm saying this 3.5 days, nearly 4 days after voting ended in the Iowa caucuses. While the precise delegate allocation out of Iowa remains uncertain, the broad picture is clear. Bernie Sanders got the most votes, with Pete Buttigieg close behind. Elizabeth Warren finished third, and Joe Biden's performance was the most disappointing. He came fourth, even though the pre-caucus polling average had him in a near tie for first with Sanders. I should note, as I do, my husband is a professional Democratic political fundraiser, and his business this cycle has included raising money to elect Pete Buttigieg. To discuss what happened in Iowa and why, we're joined by Olivia Nuzzi, Washington correspondent for New York Magazine, who was on the ground in Iowa and joins us now from the campaign trail in New England. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's looking like I was wrong about Joe Biden, who's been leading in the national polls all along and led a lot of the Iowa polls, too. And that led me to think that he was going to do well in Iowa. What went so wrong for him?
You know, from the beginning, the campaign had a lot of difficulty with their ground game. And you saw it when you would go to Joe Biden events. It reminded me a lot of 2016 and Hillary Clinton. There were very few people. The crowds were not enthusiastic. But just like in 2016, it was hard to know how important that was. It seems like you're talking about like lawn signs when you talk about crowd enthusiasm. It's not very scientific. It doesn't seem like the smartest metric by which to judge how a candidate is going to do. And so like you and like a lot of other people, I was deferring a lot to the polling averages. And in most of the polling, Joe Biden was leading. He was leading oftentimes in Iowa. He's been leading in a lot of the early states, leading nationally. And so I spent a lot of the summer on the campaign trail with him in Iowa and throughout the country. And I spent, you know, from May until just now when the caucus night was underway, trying to make sense of that disparity, I guess, between how he was polling and what I saw to be, you know, a lack of enthusiasm at his events among the people who identify as his supporters on the ground. The campaign, you know, he got in relatively late. It's hard to remember now, but he didn't get in until I think it was May officially. I know the campaign had a bit of difficulty attracting talent early on because a lot of people had already gone to Elizabeth Warren's campaign or Pete Buttigieg's campaign. And so they had trouble, you know, hiring the right kind of field staff, people that they needed to put together an operation to win the caucus. And the candidate himself was a problem. He didn't spend as much time as everybody else on the campaign trail. They didn't do as many events as somebody like Bernie Sanders, who had a really exhausting schedule. Was constantly doing multiple events a day. And, you know, Biden is, I don't think it's obvious when you listen to him speak you read about him, but he is a micromanager. He's somebody who, based on my reporting at least, tends to get wrapped up and worries about the things that he shouldn't be worrying about, like endorsements or whether or not he should even be giving the speech that he's scheduled to give. And he tends to get sidetracked by little things like that. And he's a difficult candidate to manage. And I think it was kind of a combination of the quirks of the candidate, the timing at which they got into the race, and the size of the Democratic field that contributed to the campaign just not really having the ground game that they needed. And also, when I talked to operatives, you know, over the last several months in Iowa, there's a lot of frustration about Biden's team and Biden himself and the kind of arrogance that they supposedly had, where he didn't feel that he needed to, as again, according to these operatives, Biden didn't feel that he needed to be backslapping and going out and meeting the people who are influential in these precincts, in these districts all over Iowa, that he didn't need to be playing the game the way that you really do need to play the game in caucus if you don't have the type of enthusiasm that a Bernie Sanders has. And there was a lot of frustration that, like, Biden seemed like he thought that he was kind of above or didn't need to be participating in this process because his team really does think that this is a coronation, that this is his nomination.
Tim, you were also on the ground in Iowa. Were you surprised by the result?
By the time the results were pouring in, I wasn't, because of what I had seen, as same as Olivia saying. He'd have events where it was just sort of almost lazy old efforts. You bring in John Kerry, who won Iowa in 2004. That's a long time ago now, even though, you know, I remember pretty well. You bring in the Firefighters Union, which, again, Chris Dodd brought in the Firefighters Union in 2008. This is not a way that you win the state. These are ways that you sort of kind of check boxes. And every single person I talked to at his rallies said, well, I think he's the one who can beat Trump. There was no, it was entirely just that. It was, well, I guess we have to go with this. One woman even said to me, oh, I'm afraid to vote for anybody but Biden. I like Amy better, but I'm afraid to vote for anybody but Biden because I think he's the most electable. And then I show up in a elementary school that has two precincts in it. One of them, there was no Biden precinct captain, and the other, Biden's precinct captain was an out-of-state failed politician. And in neither of these did he end up being viable, meaning he didn't get 15% in either of these two precincts in Council Bluffs, which a lot of people thought a working class type place. He was going to do well. This was blue collar Joe. But you need organization to do it. Buttigieg's campaigns had strategies for how they were going to pick up the Biden people, the Klobuchar people, and the Yang people, and they did it. And so they pulled ahead and won both the one precinct I was in, even though they were trailing Bernie. There was no such organization there. It was my colleague Phil Klein said, in the final sprint, Biden was sauntering to the finish line.
And if I could just jump in here, Josh, you know, when Biden's speech, if I agree with that, and the same exact thing happened at the precinct I was at on caucus night, about 30 miles outside of Des Moines. But you know, when you listen to Biden's speech on the campaign trail, it's hard to think of something less inspiring. He gets out there and he talks about for 30 minutes what he's not. You know, he's not Donald Trump. He's not a pie-in-the-sky socialist. And that is how he defines his candidacy. And it's not until, I think he spends maybe 3 minutes total saying what he's for, saying what he will do as president. It's really just him kind of free associating and, you know, struggling to get through his argument for why he is not like Donald Trump. And people, I mean, there's just, it seems like a stupid thing to judge it by, but people don't really applaud. They don't get on their feet. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders spends, you know, 20 minutes talking about exactly what he will do, why he will do it, why it's important. And it's not hard to see why there's such an enthusiasm gap.
Right. So, Liz, I'm wondering what you make of this result, because up until this contest, there had never been a primary or caucus in the history of the modern Democratic nominating process where you have these popular votes that produced more than three candidates with at least the 15% of the vote that you need in order to qualify for delegates. This contest produced four such candidates, and it very nearly produced five. Amy Klobuchar was only a little bit under that threshold. So you have, you know, it's a win for Sanders in the popular vote, but one of the key takeaways from this is that you're not getting the sort of clustering that you normally get in a nominating process where people start to winnow. All five of these candidates came out of this strong enough to continue on to New Hampshire. I don't think all five of these candidates will be with us on Super Tuesday necessarily. But one thing that I think you see out of this is just a very split decision by this electorate here.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see a party that could go in a lot of different ways. And I think you see a party whose sentiments are divided, right? So, like Olivia was saying, you have some people who are very, very, very focused on nothing but trying to elect the candidate they believe will be strongest against Trump, because their number one priority at this point is not constructive, it's defensive. They feel like the most important thing for the country is not any particular policy or any particular agenda or even any particular Democrat, is just getting Trump out of office in 2020. So you have people trying to figure out how to make that happen and triangulate on that front. Then you have people who are sort of the sense that because Trump is such an unusual president, because 2020 is set to be such an unusual election, possibilities are sort of endless. And we have an opportunity to really make an extraordinary political change in this country. And so there you have headwinds for a candidate like Bernie Sanders. Then you have people who say, well, maybe both. Maybe we can have someone who's a little bit lefty and maybe someone who is also safe feeling in the way that Hillary Clinton was with, you know, the imprimatur of the Clinton establishment. And there they see someone like Elizabeth Warren. And then you just have people who like that Pete Buttigieg does a really great Obama impression.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one of the remarkable takeaways of this for me is that the top two performances here seem to be from campaigns that really understood the rules. Pete Buttigieg really invested a lot in rural counties, which punch above their weight in terms of the delegate allocation. He managed to win most of the rural counties. Sanders very effectively organized these satellite caucuses that voted at regular times of day. He won smashing, almost uncontested majorities in many of them. And yet the overall turnout in this caucus was not that good. It was, you know, it looks like it's going to be a little bit higher than 2016, but significantly lower than in 2008. And that makes me wonder about how nervous Democrats should be. You know, do they really have the enthusiasm they need in this race? Does Sanders in particular, if his argument is about I can win the general election because I will activate irregular voters who wouldn't normally show up? I mean, Liz, it's not clear to me that that happened in Iowa. How do we evaluate whether Sanders can really deliver on that promise?
Well, he did do well with young people in Iowa. I mean, you know, turnout, I don't think was historic in Iowa. But if you look at the people that Sanders did get, especially in the satellite caucuses, these, you know, religious and racial minorities, he did a really good job at that. And he did activate those voters. And I think that the most important thing is that his campaign showed they can organize those voters, right? Which was actually kind of a big feat. It's not just about making voters who are irregular interested or making them inspired. It's actually about the mechanics of organizing, informing, making sure that there are logistics in place for election day so that people who do want to vote are able to and have the knowledge that enables them to make their voices heard. And I think the Sanders campaign showed itself to be very, very gifted in making that happen.
What Liz is describing here that the Sanders campaign did is what you used to have political parties do. In other words, think about, we're going to get the people to the polls. That's the stories you would hear about an old time, you know, Democratic machine or an old time Republican party. These parties don't exist. And this is not going to be a controversial statement. I don't think the Iowa Democratic Party is very good at doing its job. And so when you're looking at who the Democratic nominee is going to be, if it really matters to you that they win, you have to take into account the fact that the Democratic Party on the national level and on the state levels is very weak. So it's kind of the Republican Party, but when you control the White House, there's a level of sort of centralization and organization that you're going to have there. And so you are going to need somebody who can sort of do the nuts and bolts. The fact is that Barack Obama was absolutely amazing at organizing, at planning, at the sort of strategery that you were talking about that Buttigieg did. And I think some people thought Joe Biden was going to be that guy. But he wasn't. So the guy whose virtue was supposed electability is showing himself that he doesn't do these kinds of things Liz is talking about that help you actually win, including organizing.
I don't think anybody's going to contest Tim's claim that the Iowa Democratic Party is not very good at what it does. Olivia, I was wondering what that looked like this week on the ground as the results didn't come in and didn't come in and didn't come in. And then there were all these questions about whether the results were correct and they had to revise things that they reported previously. How was that being received by the campaigns as that process was going on?
I mean, initially, the campaigns were extraordinarily frustrated, right? But I think that a lot of the campaigns benefited from the chaos as well. I mean, obviously, Pete Buttigieg got almost two straight days where he was able to claim that he was the victor and go into New Hampshire pretending to be the front runner when we didn't know whether or not he was. And he has benefited from polling already. There's been an uptick in where he's polling in New Hampshire, and I don't know if it'll hold through primary day. But I think that that is probably worked out in Pete Buttigieg's favor, and it probably worked out in Joe Biden's favor as well. I think being able to leave Iowa in a state of uncertainty and to be able to say, no, we need to wait for the results rather than accept, a fourth place defeat immediately was probably beneficial to the campaign. But what I wanted to say is, you know, one of the strangest things to me throughout this primary has been, you know, you hear the argument from Pete Buttigieg, you hear it certainly from Joe Biden, and you hear it from Amy Klobuchar, that they are each the candidates who are going to be able to do what's absolutely necessary to win, which is to get voters who perhaps either voted for Donald Trump or could be convinced to vote for Donald Trump to actually support them instead. And that seems to me like a much harder sell, a much harder thing to accomplish than to just improve turnout among people who are definitely Democrats over 2016. And I can't really make sense of that argument. It just seems like impossible when you talk to Trump voters, even if you talk to moderate Republicans. It seems like the instances in which that would be a successful strategy, it would probably be very, very few. But to get to improve turnout, it seems like something that a party should just be able to do. It seems like there's a lot of technology that the parties could be utilizing to do that, and that they've had years now to work on that. And that is not really an argument that you hear from any campaign other than the Sanders campaign. And they've been stressing in the final days leading up to the caucus, one of the most frequent things I heard from Bernie Sanders is that if turnout was high, he would probably be doing well in the caucus. That would be a sign that they would win. If it was low, he probably would not win. That campaign is hyper aware of what turnout means for them. But the other campaigns seem much more interested in trying to convince people that they're going to get voters who hate them to somehow come to their side.
Liz, I mean, to Olivia's point there, if Olivia pointed to some reasons that the chaos and delay in reporting the results may have been good for Pete Buttigieg, may have been good for Joe Biden, this is a zero-sum game. It can't be good for all the campaigns. And I think Bernie Sanders maybe has reasons to feel like, you know, he would have been able to claim a clean victory, at least in the first preference vote, if not, you know, the delegates are going to be very close, if there had been reporting earlier. So I would imagine that they're upset about this whole situation with the Iowa Democratic Party.
Yeah, and I think they have good reason to be. I mean, the sheer incompetence and bumbling nature of the reporting here in the Iowa caucuses has created an enormous amount of chaos. I think it's going to eventually just sort of die in the news as we move on to the debate in New Hampshire, meaning that the Iowa caucuses will basically be kind of a draw with Buttigieg and Sanders both declaring victory and people saying, well, okay, both of them have a point. Is that annoying for the Sanders campaign? I'm certain that it is. On the other hand, there are reasons for this to work in Sanders' favor, right? So one of Sanders' talking points is that the Democratic Party is incompetent and that it has serious problems and that there are a lot of good reasons to kind of gut the Democratic infrastructure and replace it with better rules, better procedures, better people, and so on and so forth. And I think that this is further to that point, though, of course, the Iowa Democratic Party is not the DNC. The DNC has not helped matters with Tom Perez calling for a re-canvass. So I think that it could be helpful for Sanders on that level. It seems to have also invigorated Sanders supporters, but not necessarily for great reason. So I think there's pretty widespread belief, as far as I can tell, just observing chatter among Sanders supporters online, that there was some level of corruption or conspiracy involved here with intentional underreporting or misreporting of results to damage Sanders. And I think that is going to be hard for the IDP and the DNC to overcome. And I think it could hurt the possibility of Sanders supporters eventually supporting another nominee if it's not Bernie. So I think they have only worsened their position on that front. So again, it's hard to overstate how horrible of a failure this was and how bad it looks and what a problem it's created for the party.
In a moment, we'll delve into the nature of this failure with Rick Hassan, who is a law professor and expert on election law at UC Irvine. But let's leave that here now on this segment. Olivia Nuzzi, Washington correspondent for New York Magazine, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of the New York Times, and on the right, Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Tim Carney, what tweet struck you?
During the State of the Union these days, we all love to tweet. And people look to find little observations, make a funny little joke, or fact-check the president. Michael Barbaro noticed something during the State of the Union address. The president pointed to Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, his nominees, and the crowd applauded them, and the two faced each other and gave a nod. This spawned what I think was the tweet of the week. That knowing nod between Kavanaugh and Gorsuch when Trump mentions them, wow, the Federalist Society nod? This was a hilarious, almost conspiracy theory that when two colleagues, when they were called on in front of the whole House of Representatives and Senate, nodded towards each other, was somehow a secret signal from this conservative organization, particularly ridiculous because the Federalist Society has secret handshakes and magic rings which we use to communicate, and we would never do it on live national television.
Liz Brunig, what's your tweet of the week?
This tweet from our fallen comrade, Rich Lowry. After years of obsession
with
the Russians.
Rich is out sick this week. He will be back with us.
Rest in peace.
After years of obsession with the Russians, the Democrats somehow managed to hack their own election.
My tweet of the week comes from Nate Cohn at the New York Times. Before the Iowa caucus results meltdown, there was the CNN Des Moines Register poll meltdown when the most anticipated poll about the caucuses got pulled at the last minute because of a collection error. Apparently, one of the people who was conducting the survey had a screen with too big a font size, and that meant it cut off part of the candidate list, and some of the people who were called didn't get offered all the candidates. What a mess. And Ann Selzer, who was the pollster who ran this poll, has a reputation for doing highly accurate caucus polls, which is why everyone wanted to see this one. But Cohn argued on Monday night that her poll was similarly prescient this time. He said, no Selzer poll, no results. It was inevitable. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of the New York Times and Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner. We will be back with Rick Hassan, election law expert from UC Irvine, to talk about why the Iowa Democratic Party can't count. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at the New York Times. The New York Times pollster Nate Cohn has called this year's Iowa Democratic caucus, quote, the worst conceived and executed electoral contest I have ever seen, unquote. It's not just that the count has taken forever and that the party couldn't even get partial results announced until the afternoon following the caucuses. It's that the process has been full of mistakes. At one point, the party accidentally awarded Sanders delegates to Tom Steyer and Deval Patrick. Apparently, they had adjacent columns in a spreadsheet. The party's been fighting with the Democratic National Committee over Byzantine rules about allocating what are called state delegate equivalents from satellite caucuses. I'm not going to bore you with details, but apparently, the party's literally sent out two contradictory sets of instructions about how to allocate these delegates. And which set of instructions you use makes a difference of about four SDEs out of a couple of thousand, which sounds small, but it could be enough to mean the difference in who, quote, won that measure of the caucus. This is a less than ideal situation. And to talk about it, we're joined by Richard Hassan. Richard is a law and political science professor at the University of California at Irvine. He's an expert in election law, and his new book, which came out Tuesday, the very confusing day after the Iowa caucuses, is called Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Hi, Rick.
Good to be with you.
So this is good timing for you, at least.
Well, what's good for me is generally bad for the country. If people are calling my phone and asking me what's going on, it means that something's gone very, very wrong.
So what went wrong here? I mean, we know specifically, you know, what's been misreported out of Iowa and what's been delayed. But what do you, when you look at this election, what mistakes did the Iowa Democratic Party make in the run-up that caused this to be such a mess?
Well, I think the first thing I should say preliminarily is that it's the Iowa Democratic Party that's running this election. They do this once every 4 years. It's not the Iowa election officials who are running elections all the time. And so anytime you're dealing with, an infrequent occasion, it's going to be a problem. But here, they tried a few new things. First, they tried to report issues using a new app, an app that they hadn't trained the precinct captains how to download. They were using new counting rules. Instead of reporting one number, you had to report three numbers. They had, as you mentioned, this problem of how they were even going to calculate is a very convoluted formula. And so, and then I should say, they mishandled their mess up. So on the night of the caucus, when it was clear that they couldn't announce the results, they should have just waited until they had everything in order. Instead, you had results coming out in dribs and drabs. And then you had a situation where they had to correct some of the numbers they put out. It just made the Iowa Democrats seem like the most incompetent election administrators around.
Tim, you were at a caucus site on Monday night, and I guess you saw this election being maladministrated in real time.
Yes, it was hard for me as a dad to not try to correct the way it was being run, because clearly things were being done out of order. Voters were realigning before they had submitted a ballot for who their original alignment was for. The precinct chairman, there were two women volunteers giving their whole time. They'd gone to volunteer segments, but nobody had taught them how to talk into a microphone, so it was hard to hear in this auditorium. Many of the caucus goers were hard of hearing and didn't hear the instructions, and the precinct chair people, they counted the voters. They did a head count instead of looking at the ballot. They submitted the ballot. So all of these things went against the way that I would run it, went against the way I think they should have run it. The Bernie people left the room unhappy, thinking it had been miscounted. I'm sure it's not the only room where that had happened. The Buttigieg precinct captain had a lower count of her own voters than the chairman ended up reporting. So yeah, it was certainly a little bit messy. I've coached like youth sports teams. It felt kind of more like that than like a professional operation.
Yeah, Liz, I mean, part of Rick notes how convoluted the calculations were here. In part, this was a messy compromise. We've never had a raw vote total before in the Iowa caucuses. Normally, they report what are called state delegate equivalents. We know after this whole messy realignment process how many points basically each candidate got out of each site. But this time, for the first time, we learned how many people – or we think we learned how many people came in initially saying, I'm for candidate X, I'm for candidate Y. That ended up making the forms that these people had to fill out a lot more complicated. It sort of looked to me like basically if you handed a bunch of, you know, regular, ordinary people who are volunteering their time, if you handed them tax forms and basically were like, you know, here, calculate your taxes in 30 minutes by hand, a lot of people would screw it up. And it seems like that's exactly what happened here. And maybe an inevitable outcome of trying to please everybody in the process, basically having this initial headcount because Bernie Sanders, you know, his supporters thought maybe he would have won it last time and they wanted it to be known. And yet not changing some of the other convoluted rules that people were invested in for whatever reason in the Iowa Democratic Party.
Yeah, I mean, when there was agreement on, you know, registering all three counts, it was incumbent upon the Iowa Democratic Party at that point to train all the administrators of these different precinct caucuses on how to make that happen. The fact that they agreed to these new procedures and just figured it would all work out is baffling. It's madness. I mean, again, you can see why people are defaulting to a conspiratorial view, which is not the view that I hold. But you can see why, because it's difficult to imagine adults in the alternate universe where they realize they're going to undertake not only a completely new procedure for reporting results, but a completely new procedure for doing it using this untested app, and then feel like, well, you know, people will just sort of figure it out. It reminds me of when I was in high school doing very complicated forms of debate, and they would periodically have rounds judged by bus drivers or parents who had not only no idea how to judge this activity, but no idea how to even record their judgments on the paper ballot. And it wasn't a conspiracy then. It's not a conspiracy now, I don't think. My contacts in the Sanders campaign don't feel like they're being conspired against by the IDP. It's just that the level of incompetence is baffling and galling.
Rick, is there a good way to conduct caucuses? I mean, you note that states have professional and counties have professional election departments where people do this for a living and they're used to it. But I mean, you know, is there a way to do caucuses that ends up being fair and reflecting the intent of the voters? Or is one of the lessons here basically that states should just have regular primaries?
Well, I've been on record for a long time saying that we should junk the caucuses for other reasons, you know, in terms of how undemocratic they are. You know, people can't get to the caucus at the right time, and they can't participate in the same way. You know, the way the Republicans run it is it's essentially like a party-run primary. You know, there is not this more convoluted way of moving around if you don't reach viability. I think we should get rid of the caucuses now for another reason, which is that we can't trust the parties. I went back and looked. I wrote columns back in 2016, 2012, 2008 about problems in administering caucuses. I was just the worst example of a very common problem when you don't have professionals running an election.
Isn't there a case, though, for the idea that parties are and ought to be private entities, and that getting your name on, say, the Democratic line in an election ought to be up to the Democratic Party, that the state's job is to administer the general election? So this is kind of an old-fashioned argument I'm making, but my friend Will Wilkinson, who lives in Iowa and is on the left, he has made this argument as well, that it's a bit odd that we should have our government and these professionals you're talking about be in the business of determining, of running who is nominated by a private entity like a party.
Well, you know, primaries and the first stage of elections, it's kind of this weird hybrid because parties are private, but yet they're sometimes seen as public actors. For example, the Supreme Court said long ago that parties can't have racial discrimination in their procedures. And the Supreme Court also said that although a party can decide whether or not it wants its primary open or closed, if a state wants to say no caucus, no convention, you have to use a primary, the state can say that. So, you know, we'd have to go back in time a while back to really see this as a private activity. It's the first stage of a two-stage general election, I think, is a fair way to think about it.
Liz, I think Sanders supporters have often been inclined toward caucuses because he did especially well in caucuses in 2016. They benefit him to the extent that caucus electorates tend to be younger. Older people seem more reluctant to go out and spend hours at these meetings. And also because they tend to skew toward very active, very motivated people. And Sanders does well when the electorate skews that way. So, is there an argument for, you know, caucuses that aren't run this poorly? But, do people who are for Bernie Sanders, do they want to give up the caucus system? Do they think that that primaries are more fair because they're easier to vote in?
Well, I mean, I think that caucuses reward organizing, and that's a strength of the Sanders campaign. It's also a strength of the Obama campaign. So very activist Democrats are going to favor caucuses. I think that there's certainly a case to be made for junking caucuses that are run like this. In a perfect world where the administration of the caucuses was much better. And I think it's worth pointing out, I was talking to my colleague Nate Cohn this morning, it's quite possible that the Iowa caucuses have been really messed up forever. And that we just haven't realized it until the discrepancies emerged in the reporting because of the new rules this time. So in the end, maybe this was helpful in that it will help us to run a cleaner election going forward. But it is disturbing for the moment. Is the answer to junk caucuses altogether? I'm not to that point yet, but I'm certainly very sympathetic to people who are making that argument.
Can we turn and talk about general elections? Rick, what are you afraid of as we turn toward November? What could go wrong as states and counties try to administer a general election?
Well, I think we can see Iowa as a microcosm of what can go wrong, which is that immediately, I think, just as the Iowa Democratic Party was a little late in getting its message out, you had the Trump campaign manager and the Trump children suggesting that this was rigged. And, you know, there were messages that were being amplified by outside bots. So anytime you have a close election, people might question the results. But when we're in such a hyper-polarized environment right now, and where social media can amplify all kinds of conspiracy theories, I'm worried about the losers of the 2020 election accepting the results as legitimate. You know you're going to have 47-48% of the population that's going to be very unhappy with what happens in November. And we're going to focus our attention not on, you know, where things went right, which is likely what's going to happen in the vast majority of the country, but those places where things went wrong. And if that happens to be in a swing state where there's, some maladministration, I think we're in for a very bumpy ride.
And so what do you do from an election administration perspective to address that? Because, I mean, people are going to say what people are going to say. I don't think you can really change that that much through election policy. But what do election administrators need to do to try to encourage people to take the results as legitimate and to avoid good reasons for people to think that they are not legitimate?
It's not just election administrators, it's a lot of different groups. And I would start with the media. So the first thing is, you know, we had a negative countdown clock on CNN when the results were not announced. There's this pressure to get things out immediately. We're going to have a state like Pennsylvania, which has had its fair share of election administration problems in the past. It is going to switch to a brand new system of absentee balloting at will, like we have here in California. And there's going to be a flood of ballots. It's going to take days to report. And so one of my nightmare scenarios is that Trump could be ahead on election night, but there will be hundreds of thousands of ballots yet to count. And over the next few days, as the negative countdown clock is going on CNN, eventually his Democratic opponent is declared the winner. And if Pennsylvania is the pivotal state, then, you know, you could have two different sides declaring themselves the winner and lots of people not believing that the later count was fair. We saw Trump do this very thing in 2018 in the U.S. Senate race in Florida between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott, where he suggested that ballots counted after Election Day were, quote, massively infected, even though there was zero proof of that. So I'm really worried about maladministration combined with conspiracy theories and agitation in a way that could cause people to doubt the very results of the election.
Rick Hassan of the University of California at Irvine, his new book is called Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, it's your soapbox.
A lot of secular folk on the left worry about religion creeping too much into politics. I think what Donald Trump showed us at the National Prayer Breakfast was that the exact opposite is the problem, that the religious right is sort of losing the religious part and just becoming an arm of the Republican Party. Because Trump went before the prayer breakfast and belittled the idea, said by the previous speaker, that we ought to love our enemies. Love our enemies is not an idea made up by Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute or by some squishy Republicans or by Democrats at all. It comes from Jesus's Sermon on the Mount. And so at a national prayer breakfast, Trump belittled the idea that we ought to love our enemies, belittled the teachings of Jesus, and he was still applauded and cheered, which is to say, if you thought the religious right was a threat to America, you're really not going to like the irreligious right.
Liz Brunick, what's your rant?
So following up on that, Nancy Pelosi said this week that she prays for Donald Trump. Donald Trump said he didn't buy it. But he wasn't the only person criticizing Pelosi for having said she prays for Trump. A lot of folks on the left were also not happy to hear it. Putting aside whether it's sincere, you can never know what's in somebody's heart, especially where something like faith is concerned. I don't think that people quite understand what it means to pray for somebody. And I think this emerges a lot in our discourse, especially when we do thoughts and prayers stuff after tragedies and shootings and so forth. But when you say you pray for your enemies and when we're told to pray for our enemies, at least in the Catholic tradition, which is all I can speak for, it doesn't mean you're praying that they get what they want or that they succeed in what they're trying to do or that all their dreams come true. That's not how praying works. You pray that God's will is done and that he use us all for the good. That's all.
For my rant, we talked about Nancy Pelosi's speech-ripping stunt at the end of the State of the Union. This, of course, drew a counter-stunt. Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz wants to bring charges against Pelosi for destruction of government records because she ripped the speech up. There was extensive pearl-clutching about Pelosi's move, often from people who support Donald Trump strongly. And Trump, lest we forget, bragged about the size of his hands and the implications of the size of his hands on a presidential debate stage, among many, many, many transgressions against decorum. It's unfortunate that our politics are like this, but it is what it is. I suggest not letting yourself get too worked up about it. A ripped speech is not high on our list of problems. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Tim Carney, Liz Brunig, Olivia Nuzzi, and Rick Hassan. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.